There we go. The theme for the practice period is we're looking at how to engage in the world. And that's in a very broad way, how we engage in the world. How do we, I put it a little bit like this. How do we fully express our life in the world? How do we fully express our life in this world? And how do we engage in those troubled aspects of our life, most of them which we blame on somebody else or on the world in general? I don't think Buddhism offers a solution to the kind of great dilemmas that we face today, in the sense of, you know, climate warming and the homelessness, the wars that we see going on. I don't think we can, like, look in the text and, you know, we'll find a kind of prescription there. But I think what this tradition will offer us is a way to simply stand firm to face the challenges that we all face, both in our everyday life, our life of the family, with friends, in this society, in this city, and of course in the world. I think Buddhism will give us the tools to be able to truly engage in whatever we're called to do in this world. But I think, first of all, we need to be honest. I think many of us come to practice, to this tradition, not to further engage in the world, but to find refuge from it. Get me out of here. Thank you very much. Beam me up, please. And maybe that's true for you as well. Like, you know, please, I'd like a little peace, a little security. I'd like to be, I'd like not to have suffering so close. And so battered and kind of buffeted by the eight worldly winds, as we talk about in this tradition, the winds of pain and pleasure, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, or maybe just being disappointed and at a loss because life does not unfold as I want it to. Or maybe it's because we've been gripped in some terrible calamity, and for all these reasons we naturally seek a refuge, a place of peace and security. And the Buddhist tradition does offer refuge. Refuge in the Buddha, as a model of life, of how we perhaps model our life. Refuge in the Dharma as a set of guidelines and helpful teachings about how we can conduct ourselves and view the world. And very importantly, refuge in Sangha. Refuge in Sangha as a community of people, kind of fellow travelers, kind of committed in one degree or to or another to this idea of awakening, to really being fully alive in all aspects. We all seek refuge. Me too. But I've noticed as we practice, and as the practice informs our understanding of the way things really are, we come to see that the refuge that we really need is not from the world at all. The refuge we really need is from ourselves, from the stories that we hold about who we are and about what our relationship is to the world at large. There are so many stories we tell ourselves. Each person, I'm sure, has many stories. And most of those stories, I think, include, at least in part, stories about being alone, stories about being separate from the world, from others, stories about somehow being inadequate, flawed, stories about being lost in this seamless, meaningless world that we find ourselves in. And maybe for some of us, stories of being denied, stories of having to struggle or even fight to get to one's place, to find one's place in this world. Buddhist practice, I think our practice both on and off the cushion, is partly to bring our awareness to these stories, these many stories that we hold and run repeatedly throughout our day, and for the first time, see them for what they really are. They are just stories that we have constructed. Some of these stories, of course, rising from our family history. It's a family story that's maybe carried on from generation to generation. Some of the stories from our culture and society about what it means to be successful or to be a failure. And maybe many stories, too, from our personal experience that we had at some point, childhood, teenagehood, adulthood. And in various ways, you know, these kind of stories, they come together into what we might call the self story, the story of who I am. This is the story of Michael. Let me tell you the story of Michael. You know, this happened to him, that happened to him. We could all, I'm sure, spend quite a bit of time, you know, if we really thought about it, laying out a long story about who we are. But with practice and some insight into the nature of our self-story, the shadowing and kind of ever-changing quality of that story that we have so long held on to be fixed, like, this is me, this is me. I think that shadowy and changing nature becomes a little more apparent, and we can't kind of hang on to it with that same grip, that same tenacity that we had earlier. And hopefully, again with practice, we begin the journey back to a more spacious place, a spacious relationship with the world, and and perhaps really come to know it for the first time. This is the world and my intimacy with it. It's only fairly recently in the West, because we've been caught up in our enthusiasm over Buddhist meditation practices, I think, largely. It's only fairly recently that we've come to recognize that Buddhist practice is much more than just a meditation, or that awakening is not leaving the world, finding some nirvanic place, but actually entering into it. Entering into it fully. Over the centuries, the Buddhist tradition, as it developed, created many models, kind of options that for us to follow in this kind of journey of awakening, of kind of really facing and allowing our life to be fully there, to fully inhabit our life. You know, the Eightfold Path is one example. Kate yesterday, you know, talked about the ox herding pictures. That's kind of another example of the journey that we can go on. There's many kind of models or presentations up there for us. And that's good, because these give us options that will fit, I think, different personalities and perhaps different times where we find ourselves in life. And today I'd like to talk about the paramitas as a model. As a model for awakening, and as a model for finding a way to engage in the world. Now, even within the Paramitas, when we look at the Buddhist texts, you know, there are many kind of variations. 10, 6, 9, just kind of like they fluctuate a little bit. But today, I'd like to talk about six qualities, make the list six, because that seems to be pretty common in a lot of the earlier Mahayana texts. And these qualities are generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. And certainly any one of these would be a topic for a book, let alone a Dharma talk, and I can't cover all these. But I thought I would pick three out of the six, just to highlight, because I feel these are ones that will really help us as we kind of bring our life and our practice out into the world. And also there are three that I thought I could condense into a little Dharma talk. So let's see how it goes. So I'm going to look at generosity, patience, and energy. Now, some of you may not, they may think, well, what the heck are paramitas anyway? they're often translated as, the word is translated as perfection or perfections. So we could say the perfection of generosity, perfection of morality, perfection of energy, etc. And when I looked at a little bit of the scholarly background, it seems pretty interesting that scholars are not really sure what the word originally mean, or the original meaning of the word paramita. We're not sure what it is. But in the Buddhist tradition, it really refers to qualities that we can cultivate for awakening. And I find that very fascinating, because often, you know, in the West we've tried to think of, you know, we're stuck with what we got. You know, if you're a short-tempered person, you're a short-tempered person. That's kind of the way we don't really think of, like, actually cultivating positive qualities within us. And that's something, I think, one of the great gifts of the Buddhist tradition. They say, yes, you can cultivate positive qualities. You're not stuck like an old record. So we could think of the paramitas perhaps as trainings. The training of generosity, the training of energy, etc. And those people, it's kind of like you know how we exercise to build up muscles. At least some of us do, some of us don't. But we exercise to build up muscles. In the same way, they say, you know, you exercise these qualities and you build them up. They strengthen within you. They become clear, more vital, more alive within you as you practice these. And we'll talk about what that means a little bit later in the talk here. And in the Mahayana tradition, those people who take up the practices, these paramitas, are referred to as bodhisattvas, or beings, awakening beings, beings who have devoted themselves to this path of awakening. And everyone here who's wearing one of those, the rakusu, one of those square cloths, have taken these vows, you know, to awaken. But just a word about bodhisattvas, again, for people who may not be quite familiar with them. There's kind of two ways that we talk about bodhisattvas or refer to them in the Buddhist tradition. One is that bodhisattvas are enlightened or kind of almost enlightened beings. And they kind of represent the ideals of the Buddhist tradition, like perfect wisdom, perfect compassion. They're kind of like models or archetypes for us that we can like turn to and kind of like imagine and try to emulate in some way. So Kanon or Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion, and Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, etc. So if you read Buddhist texts, these bodhisattvas will be referred to. And you see them, especially if you go to visit any of the Buddhist temples, say in Richmond, the Chinese Buddhist temples or Japanese Buddhist temples. Quite beautiful. But the other way that we use the word bodhisattva is to talk about people like you and me. When we decide we really want to take this path to awakening. In some way, we really want to awaken, and not just for ourselves, but for everybody, for our friends, for the people we love, you know, for the people on the street. They are, sometimes I call them the average Joe and Jane bodhisattvas, committed to the practice of the paramitas, of practicing these kind of qualities. And so these bodhisattvas walk the road towards compassion and wisdom while dealing with the messiness of daily life and our own limitations. So even if we come to this path, this Buddhist path and this Buddhist tradition, first as a refuge from the world, with more or less a focus on our own well-being and a concern that really doesn't extend much beyond our own lives. And this is how I came first to the Buddhist tradition, to this practice. But as we train, as we practice, and particularly as we enter into these paramitas, we naturally start to drop the narrow story of ourself that we have held on to for so long. And we begin to open up to a more kind of comprehensive view, a view that goes beyond our own personal well-being. We begin to open up to the world and discover that the world is us. The world is us. Yesterday, outside, after we had lunch, there was a woman with two shopping carts full of bags, you know, sitting outside our door here, you know, eating her lunch. And without conscious thought, one of the first things that arose for me was a kind of sadness or warmth to her, and at the same time a little bit of wish, hope she moves on. That it's painful to see this, and then to come back, you know, oh, here she is, and you know, and what would this be like, a life to live on the street, living with shopping carts. That's, you know, all your possessions in two shopping carts. She is not other. So let's have a look at the first paramita that I mentioned, this paramita of generosity, and kind of consider how this might connect us to the world, kind of open us up a little bit more to the world in a wholesome way. So I'd like you for a moment to remember a time when you were generous, when you gave with kind of a clear willingness of some object or some time, maybe some concern that you had for somebody that you expressed. Just can you remember something? And recall how you felt at that time. And when you remember it, how does it feel now to remember that time when you were generous? And now, just If you can remember a time when you received, you were the recipient of a generous act. Somebody gave of their time, gave of their material goods, gave of their love and concern for you. And how did you feel then? How does it feel to remember now? In Asia, along with the basic kind of moral precepts, the five basic precepts, the Buddhist path there begins with generosity. You know, as an example from the time of the Buddha and the monks and nuns would wander around, homeless, more or less, but they would beg for their food every day. And so it was an act of generosity, a kind of freely given act of generosity by the community that supported the monks and nuns during that period of time. And the monks and nuns, in turn, would freely give of their dharma, their experience, the teachings to the lay people. And this is true also today when we go to places in Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, etc. The monks beg for food, and the laity provide them with food and clothing. And in Japan as well, this practice still continues within the Zen tradition of monks in training will go on takahatsu, which means they carry a little bowl and they chant and walk around the community, and people will give donations of uncooked rice, usually little bags of raw rice, or they'll give some money, and that helps to support the practice there. So that's the beginning of practice in Asia. That's how young children would learn, or adults would practice as well, by and large. So kind of in rather stark contrast to kind of me focus that brings us to practice, right? How am I going to fix this disaster, this walking disaster? Doesn't this emphasis on generosity kind of really teach us that the Buddhist path is first one of relationship? It's first one of relationship, connection to others. When I was thinking about this, you know, generosity in the practice, and it's again so much more we could say about that, it really occurred to me that the reason we can do acts of generosity is because of others who came before us. So even the act of being able to be generous is because of the generosity of others that came before us, who taught us, you know, this is how you can be generous. These people have created the culture and the conditions that we are able to be generous. That thanks to them, we understand the kind of a collective realization about the beauty and the importance of being generous. Does that make sense? Am I kind of making that clear? We can take up this practice of generosity in large part because of the efforts and connections to those who came before us. And when I think about this and contemplate this, it really broadens my sense of who I am and in the myriad ways that I've been touched and influenced by others who have come before. And of course, the act of generosity is the fundamental foundation of practice, because it is the practice of letting go of my time, my food, my money, my clothes. An act of generosity can open our hearts. It can clear away the barriers we build around ourselves and bring us closer to freedom. Because with every act of generosity, whether it's given or received, we acknowledge our interdependence and our profound connection to the world and to those around us. For most of us, though, acting with generosity does not come easily, because we have not been really taught or shown by our parents or maybe our mentors or teachers to really understand that in giving we become free. In giving we become free. Certainly in this society we're told the exact opposite, aren't we? By and large, that happiness arises when we get what we want. This kind of car, this size house, only then will we become content. And yet, over time, we become more and more aware that this is really a delusion, because even when we get the car, that happiness only lasts for a little bit of time, and then, as I can tell my students, you get iPhone 5, and before you know it, iPhone 6 is out, and now it's iPhone 7. You'll never catch up. So perhaps it's not in getting, but in giving. Is this where happiness is? Where it lies? I think the practice of generosity, whether it's with our material goods, our money, or our time, or our love, needs to be developed carefully and mindfully. It's said that generosity, according to the Buddhist text, results in an open and spacious mind. A mind that resides in wealth and abundance no matter what your circumstances are. A mind and a being that is pliable, not restricted. And finally, it is a place where other good qualities can arise and thrive, like loving kindness and compassion. So, I'd like to suggest a practice for us. Let's say for the next 2 weeks, we don't be too extravagant here. But I'd like each of us to commit to one spontaneous act of generosity every day. So in other words, not too much thinking about it. And an act of giving to another being or giving to the earth. And then you pay attention to what arises in you. The kind of emotional state, the thoughts, just pay attention to what arises. And then the other practice that parallels this, that also we need to do, is, again, for the 2 weeks, I'd like you to refuse no act of generosity directed towards you, unless you're fairly confident that it is unwholesome, either for the giver or for yourself. Have you noticed how often we refuse? Oh, I can't do that. Oh, I can't possibly take that. No, please don't buy me lunch. I'll pay for it. No. Stop it. Just say, oh, thank you, how kind. That's very generous of you, very sweet. I deeply appreciate it. Give the gift of generosity when you receive. And finally, when you're sleeping, before you go to sleep at night, I'd like you just to reflect on the gifts you have received. Again, either from the earth or from others. And kind of acknowledge that interdependence, how your life is woven into this world and with others. So those are three things, but don't worry, they won't take too long. At home, for example, There's a calligraphy that Kate and I have on the wall that was given to us. And it says in characters, it says, seeing colors gladdens the heart. Seeing colors gladdens the heart. Isn't that true? You go outside and you see the autumn colors, you see the flowers, you see the green, and doesn't that gladden the heart? It's kind of a gift from the earth to us. At one point I wondered if we should have different colored zabuton. The next paramita I'd like to look at is the paramita of patience. Interesting number of people talked to me yesterday about patience when we were doing Doksan. And patience, in at least the Sanskrit word, is often translated as forgiveness or tolerance, forbearance, letting go. Lots of ways. But Norman has said, Dzogchen Norman Fisher, who's our teacher, has said this is his favorite paramita. I think it's pretty cool. We should all have a favorite paramita that we practice. But anyway, patience is his. And when we face persistent obstacles in our practice or in our life, it is the kind of strength of character that allows us to move forward. In other words, not to turn away or get angry, but just to move forward, in other words. So rather than losing our head, kind of in anger or giving up, this paramita offers us training for composure and calm in the midst of adversity. I suppose we could say it is the fundamental practice of not turning away from the pain, confusion, and sorrows of our life and this world, but rather to respond, and hopefully, effectively, respond in some way. And patience, unfortunately, doesn't get very good press today. It's kind of seen as submissive, dull, for wimps. But while passiveness can be mistaken for patience, it really is patience which steadies us and allows for the arising of equanimity to be clear and patient in this time of turmoil. And with equanimity, we can turn our reaction, whether it's anger or turning away, turn that into a response. We will respond to this. When tough times cause our good intentions to fall into hopelessness, or our warmth and open feelings to kind of wither into irritations, and our understanding to cloud over with confusion, I think patience helps us not to flare back with harmful speech or behaviors, or just kind of simmer within. Patience, though, is not just holding still. It is also the courageous act of not turning away from our life or from the world. So how do we train in patience? Well, I thought since Norman said this is my favorite paramita, I thought I'd have a little quote about how he trains using this. And I find it's really quite wonderful. He writes, "The practice of patience is simple enough. When difficulty arises, notice the obvious and not so obvious ways that we try to avoid it. The things we say we do, the subtle ways in which our very bodies recoil and clench when someone says something or does something that we don't like. To practice patience is to notice these things and be fiercely present with them. Taking a breath helps, returning to mindfulness body helps, but be present with them rather than reacting. We catch ourselves running away, and then we reverse course. We come back. Turning toward our afflictive emotions and understanding they are natural in these circumstances, don't beat yourself up, but also knowing avoiding does not work. We Instead, allow them to be present with dignity. Isn't that interesting? We allow our aversion, our unpleasant emotions to be present with dignity. We forgive ourselves for having them. We forgive, at least provisionally, whoever we may be blaming for our difficulties. And with that spontaneous forgiveness comes a feeling of relief and maybe even gratitude. Can you forgive yourself for being upset? Well, sometimes yes, and maybe sometimes no. But it's well worth asking the question. So I think Norman is telling us that this paramita, how we can work with this, it's really kind of like a meditative discipline of working with everything that confronts us. It makes us uncomfortable or causes us pain. And with this practice, we can engage with the unfairness of life. And isn't life unfair? I mean, I'm 60-something and I still think, at times, this is so unfair. Hey. And when we seem to be overwhelmed, whether by personal difficulties or by the stories about the environment, the social issues that are present today. And this is so important for us, because when we cultivate this practice of patience, this will give us freedom from the tyranny of despair. Because that's the other choice. I give up. I despair of this world. I despair of this life. I despair of this relationship. I despair of myself. And surely the world and the people we love, this earth, needs more than ever our careful and fully present heart. More than ever before. So I've gone over 37 minutes. I'm going to try to wind this up in the next 3 minutes. I'm trying not to go over 40. So the last paramita that I really wanted to talk about, maybe I should have started this one because it's most interesting, is the paramita of energy. And energy, the Sanskrit word is virya, and it's connected to the English word virile, right? To be virile, like, you know. And it's also translated as enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. So it seems a little odd, at least I certainly have thought it odd when I first came across this, to consider that energy as a training. I mean, how do you train in energy? But isn't really this cultivation of energy really key for engagement with life and with this world? Now, when I think of energy, and the reason maybe this is why I think it's so odd, you know, what comes to my mind is kind of like billiard balls crashing into one another, like, you know, high school physics, the energy gets transferred from the blue ball to the red ball, goes that way. Or electrons kind of flowing down a wire, or, you know, the little energy bunny on the ad, you know, because he has his batteries. And really, we seldom consider it something we can cultivate as part of our spirit. But in fact, our spiritedness is nothing but energy, when I think about it. And certainly in the Buddhist tradition, physical, emotional, and spiritual energy is considered necessary if we are going to live our life constructively, both for others and for ourselves. We must have these three forms of energy, and they are talked about in the early texts. So while we may live our life without committing crimes or actively hurting other people, it's pretty clear that without cultivating energy, we will not live our life to capacity, and we won't be able to contribute to the welfare of the world. One of the great Buddhist philosophers, Shantideva, who lived in India during the 8th century, he defined energy, in the Buddhist sense, as the effort to do what is skillful, the effort to do what is skillful. And the opposite of energy as apathy or despondency. Well, that was a little bit of help, maybe. But in our efforts to do what's skillful for ourselves or in relationships or even skillful for the world, we often fail. Or maybe we feel that we have failed. And then it's pretty easy to fall into the despondency and apathy because our hopes and expectations are not met. So what do we do then? Clearly, those moments are when we really need to bring forth energy. The energy of courage and the energy of fortitude to continue on. And how do we do this? Well, Shantideva gives us one hint. And it's from a poem, a long poem. I'm just going to read one verse. He writes, "What is energy? It is finding joy in what is wholesome. Its opposite factors are explained as laziness, attraction, etc., etc. It is finding joy in what is wholesome." I'll come back to that in just a moment. I think when we begin to work with this paramita, we can start by first making a conscious decision to apply our energy to our practice and to wholesome actions. Perhaps committing to daily sitting, to joining a sangha, to volunteering. I mean, we make a commitment to direct our energy to a certain way. And this commitment or this decision, I think, is really important. Because in making a decision, in making commitment, we cut off other possible actions in favor for this action, for this direction that we want to go. We focus our life. And in focusing our life, we open it to a potential depth and richness that otherwise we will not experience. So in traditional Buddhism, this focusing, this making a decision is now recognized as making a vow. We make a vow. And that's really how the whole Buddhist tradition started, because Buddha, Siddhartha realized, I don't understand how to live a life like this. Sickness, old age, and death everywhere. And he made a vow. He directed his energy to a certain path. And I think that's true of our practice as well. At some point, whether we articulate it clearly or not, we make a vow. This is important. This is how I want to live my life. This I need to explore. And this is how I'll channel my energy. Forget late night TV talk shows. No more of those. I'm directing my energy here, on this cushion. So at some point, we vow not to turn away from the pain and confusion of our life and of this world, and we direct our attention toward it. And the most famous of this, of course, is the Bodhisattva vows, right, that we take, that we'll say at the end of the talk, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And this is a source of energy. The early Buddhist practitioners clearly saw that when we simply reach out to help, we are gifted with energy. Or maybe more accurate to say is we uncover this natural energy. We help, we make a vow, we move forward. And the fundamental vow is to examine our life. And through this examination, when we deeply examine our life and we see our life for what it is, the world naturally enters us. Dogen, the famous quote by Dogen, right? To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. So making a vow, keeping it in our hearts and minds, I think that enlivens and inspires our practice and helps us to deepen the practice and engage in the world. Because we begin to realize they're not two separate things. Take joy in what is wholesome, Shantideva tells us. This is the practice of receiving the great sweetness of life. Affirming our intention of mindfulness, we notice the color of trees after the rain. We notice those first sips of coffee in the morning. The moments when the cat acts goofy. The touch of a lover or friend. The happy smile of a child or a stranger. The practice of taking joy is to taking the time to notice and appreciate and allow the gratitude to arise because there is joy all around. And when we consistently taste this ever-present natural sweetness of life, we are enlivened and we enliven others. And then what do we do with all this energy? Well, I think it's like the plants that absorb the energy from the sun, turning into food for other creatures. The energy we absorb from this world, from this life, from this practice, we pass on to others. We offer it up for the benefit of all beings. For we have been born into a world that is in dire need of our help.